Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hello, and welcome back to The Prospect Interview, where we meet some of the brightest minds of today and talk about the ideas that matter in politics, arts, and society. I'm Rebecca Liu. Today we're talking to writer Julia Bell about social media platforms and the attention economy. Julia has recently published Radical Attention, a book on the battle for attention in the age of distraction. Her essay explores how the internet and smartphones have transformed us as human beings, and the costs that these supposedly free websites have exacted on our lives and minds. In a time of infinite distraction, Julia calls instead for what she calls radical attention, the art of emptying our own chaotic minds to redirect one's focus elsewhere. Thanks so much for joining us, Julia. To start off with, what made you want to write Radical Attention?
Well, I had an essay that went viral a couple of years ago, and it was a really interesting experience because suddenly I found myself completely and utterly addicted to my phone. In a way that was actually sort of life-threatening. I'm walking across the crosswalk looking at it. I'm not paying attention to traffic. I also kind of got massively anxious because I thought I had to respond to everything everybody was saying all at once. You know, it was very pleasing to start with, and then it started to get a bit overwhelming. And then I think as a consequence of that, I started to realize how much time I was actually spending on social media, just scrolling through information and news, because obviously, you know, you're follower count increases, you get more people on Facebook, you see more stuff. So suddenly there was just this acceleration of more, and I was getting very exhausted by it. And then also I think running alongside that is a lot of political concern about how come Donald Trump, how come Brexit, how did these things happen? How did our body politic suddenly become so poisoned? And I think I feel that, you know, some of the ways in which we're using the internet has caused some of these things. So it's a personal problem and a much bigger political issue, I think, too.
Mm. And taking a leap back, one of the starting anecdotes in your book go back to the early 1990s in Birmingham, where you're logging on to the first Mac that you will encounter. And there is a sense of joy and delight you have there. Tell me about how throughout the years, your attitude towards technology and social media has shifted from that initial moment.
Yeah, I mean, I think I'm part of the generation that remembers growing up without it, which I think, you know, is increasingly perhaps interesting to think about. And I had use of the internet from my early 20s. So a friend had a Mac, and I logged on, like I talk about in the book, and I said hello, and somebody said hello back. And I remember screaming. I was like, oh my God, this is amazing. This is going to change everything. And then I went to university to do an MA in 95, and I got an email address. And I remember very clearly that the computer lab, it was just, you know, it was academics sort of screwing things together to see what happened. There was a sort of sense of experiment, and people were all sort of trying to figure out how it might work. And then I found that it was quite exciting. There were ways of publishing work, disseminating work. You could build a web page, you could swap music, it was Napster. There was all sorts of sense that it was this exciting new invention that was going to change the way we interacted with each other, or the way we shared knowledge with each other, maybe. And I think it's really only been in the last kind of 10 years, and I think particularly perhaps in the last six or seven maybe, that the whole thing started to feel really strange and unwieldy, and it's a monopoly, and it's driven by profit, and it's not necessarily something that it has any of those kind of excites. Scary. It started to become frightening. It flipped. It really, really flipped. And I mean, I can't exactly put a date on it, but I think that I would say that it's sort of from kind of 2010 onwards.
Yeah, it's incredible how quick it's been, because I remember even growing up with dial-up, and I would go on a lot of these specific forums about ballet dancing. I was very into ballet, you know, online pet games and things like that. And I think there was a degree of, oh, we're here for a purpose, so we're sharing things and we're sharing interests, in a way that I think now everything feels like it's been captured by these specific sites, and people aren't on there with necessarily a shared sense of community.
Well, I think the thing that's happened now is that our interactions online are being scrutinized so heavily. Mm-hmm. So before, there was a sense that one really was just peer-to-peer speaking to somebody else, and there wasn't anything else interacting with that. Now, everybody's creaming off data from that, from those interactions all the time, in order to sort of, I don't know what, do what with it. I mean, you know, sometimes that's just to sell me some toothpaste, but sometimes that might be also to sell me to voting for somebody that I might not be a good idea, or suppressing my vote, or, you know, all kinds of other things, telling me that QAnon conspiracies or whatever.
So you discuss visiting San Francisco in the early 2000s, or in the book you write about returning in 2016. Tell us a little bit about how you saw the city change and what that revealed to you about the tech industry and its values.
Yeah, and I think one of the reasons why I'm interested in this is my sister. Well, she works for Google, so I should say that now. And we have lots of conversations about this kind of topic. And she moved out there in 2004, so I went out there pretty much every year for a period of over 10 years. And it was really interesting to watch, really, from a kind of, I suppose, tourist point of view, although I did spend about 6 months out there in 2007, how accelerated everything got. The money, the sheer amount of cash that Google and Facebook and Twitter and Microsoft and Apple generated over, it was hyper. It was so fast. And I think the city just became a sort of dorm room for Google campus and Apple campus. Real estate prices went ridiculous. Loads of remodeling. The city sort of changed shape, suddenly skyscrapers everywhere. And it was a much more kind of relaxed, sort of hippie, interesting literary place for me. It was somewhere where, you know, the beat poets had come out of there. There was Kerouac's bar. There was a relationship for me with literature and the art scene. And suddenly it was big tech. And it had that sort of, Timothy Morton calls technology a sort of hyper object. It's something that's happening to us. And it's so big and so fast that it's hard for us to pass it or talk about it in a simple way. And I just got that feeling of vertigo, I think, when I went back, particularly in 2016. I just thought, wow, this city's really changed.
Thinking about San Francisco particularly, so many of these companies have these grand democratic ideals, but you see what they've done to these neighbourhoods, and it's completely the opposite of that.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think we've really got to drill back to the profit motive. How come these companies are making so much money on a product that's essentially free? What would Twitter look like if you paid a subscription for it? What would Facebook look like if you had to pay a subscription for it? It would look really, really different. Because at the moment, the algorithms are primed to find out as much information from you as possible in order to target you with the most likely things that you're going to spend money on. So let's say you're doing loads and loads of doom scrolling and you're, you know, frightened about the future. Well, the company selling you tents and survival kits are going to make a lot of money out of that. So it's in their interest to figure out who's interested in, you know, creating a sort of a safe haven in the countryside or whatever things they might want to do. And I don't think that helps the conversation. There's nowhere inside that kind of bubble where somebody might break in and go, well, hey, what, there's a community group meeting to sort of figure out some issues around the climate in the neighborhood. Why don't you join in? It's not offering a solution, it's just selling you stuff.
And you touched on something there, which is, it's not just that these platforms are changing how we interact online, but they're changing how we are offline as well. You have this bit in the book where you remember in the past, before all of this, you'd be able to sit down and write for 4 hours uninterrupted. And that sort of really changed. So can you describe a bit about how these platforms are changing our behaviors and even our minds offline?
Well, I think they're changing our relationship with ourselves, because we're expected now to see ourselves as a product, which we have to go out into the world and sell, which means all of the creative writing that you're doing isn't being done. I mean, I teach creative writing, so I'm coming from this, from that point, very much from that point of view, which is that to write something, you know, great and to create great art, in a way you need to sort of be slightly fearless, and you need to not worry, and you need to not think, oh, you know, 200,000 people are going to read this and they're all going to shout at me and tell me I'm dreadful, or they're going to try and shame me in some way. And suddenly I find that students are approaching the page with an enormous amount of fear, because they know that it matters to their cultural capital. So they have to have some stuff which they can go out into the world and sell, that people will look at and say is good, or, you know, will be prepared to pay money for, or whatever, or give them some kickback. And at the same time, they also have to sort of perform this version, this persona of themselves. And I think that's incredibly, it's stultifying. It stops people from being creative. It makes everybody paranoid. So suddenly we're all atomized from each other in order to try and make cash and get somebody to notice us. I don't know if you saw the Paris Hilton documentary recently.
I haven't, very, but my friends have told me to watch it.
It's very, very interesting, because, you know, she talks about herself at one point and she says, oh, I'm just a cartoon version of myself. And there's a sort of sense that there's a very stunted personality there who can't quite figure out why she's so miserable and lonely, who spent her life building up an empire of this persona. And actually, when you start to look at how she came of age and all the rest of it, it was incredibly abusive. You know, there were all sorts of dreadful things that happened to her. And she came of age just at that moment when, you know, Instagram and the internet was really providing people with an opportunity to almost create a career out of being an influencer. She was one of the first.
That's what I was just thinking when you were speaking, is in a way she was almost a precursor to the model of a human that all of us are encouraged to be now.
Exactly. And I think it's really messing our mental health. I think it's really messing with our mental health. I think it's messing with our health on mental health on a global scale.
Yeah. And we were talking about this just before we started recording, but you know, one of my personal reasons I was so drawn to your book is I had a similar experience writing for the internet. And it's really hard. I had a writing block for about 7 months. I just couldn't write because all I could think of was this expectant public.
No, really. And because the internet can sort of do things at scale. So, you know, you might be moving along, publishing a few things and a few hundred people will see it. And then suddenly, for whatever reason, suddenly it's 10,000 people, it's 100,000 people, and it's completely out of your control. And also that people are suddenly twisting what you've said, or that there's a whole load of kickback on Twitter because of this, that, and the other, that someone's commented on something else. And then it becomes a news story. And it's like, whoa. That I think is also frightening.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast. And up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/ACAST.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
And I also think that's another thing that is also manufactured. So I find quite often that things that have happened online become a news story. You know, J.K. Rowling's been in the news recently. I don't know who else. It's always there's somebody being held up as being the pariah or the terrible person, or, you know, cancelling this person or cancelling that person. And I think that quite a lot of that is a real frustration that people on the internet want to see things changing. So they want in real life things to change, because they realise that all of this tweeting and outraging isn't getting them anywhere. It's not changing anything. Nothing changes. You can sort of sit there and be angry at people, and then it becomes a news story. But then 2 minutes later, it'll be Katie Hopkins. 3 minutes later, it'll be somebody else. You know, these outrages, they're entirely manufactured in order to keep you on the website. So again, we don't get a real sense of what's really going on. I think the news becomes very fractured and difficult to digest.
Yeah, and a luminary or a hopeful figure throughout the book is the 20th century French thinker Simone Weil. So can you explain a bit who she is and why she was such an important figure for you in writing this book?
Yeah, I think she's amazing. Susan Sontag talks about her and says that she's inspiring and annoying in equal measure. And I think that's probably true. She was a kind of mystic. She was religious, but she wasn't really sure about religion. She was a philosopher, but she also insisted that she went off and worked in the factories in France along with all of the poor people that she felt there. She was a real socialist. And she died at very young. I mean, she was only in her early 30s when she died of tuberculosis, which she picked up, you know, by not taking care of herself properly. And she also studied with Simone de Beauvoir. I think it's really interesting that when she met Simone de Beauvoir, she said it's quite clear that she's never been hungry, which I thought was a really interesting, shady thing to say. But her thinking on attention is really the thing I'm interested in. And then I think Iris Murdoch picks up on it a bit later in a book called The Sovereignty of Good. And really the argument is that it's attention is the way that we kind of learn. It's the way that we are able to digest what's happening around us. And it's how we choose. It's what we choose to look at. Now, if the internet has been programmed to sort of deliberately hijack our attention, then we're not choosing anything. And I think that it's affecting our learning. It's affecting our sort of moral compass. And I think Simone Weil kind of explains quite clearly to me, certainly as a teacher, because I'm really trying to get people to pay attention in the classroom in a particular way, what attention means, perhaps in an education setting, but also in a kind of personal setting. What does it mean to really pay attention to something? What does it feel like? What's cognitively, what's happening inside my head? So I look to her for sort of to describe that for me, because I felt that she really nails it. She pins it down really well.
And to give our listeners a bit of a flavour of what she thought, would you be able to read a portion of your book where you quote her?
Yes, I will. Above all, our thoughts should be empty, waiting, not seeking anything, but ready to receive in its naked truth the object which is to penetrate it. All wrong translations, all absurdities in geometry problems, all clumsiness of style and all faulty connection of ideas, all such things are due to the fact that thought has been seized upon some idea too hastily, and thus being prematurely blocked is not open to the truth. And I think what she means in that extract is that in order to really think about something, we've got to sort of cast aside our ego really and our preconceptions. If you come to something fresh and actually really try and look at it and think, well, what does this mean? And I suppose I tried to do that with technology, or at least with the internet. I tried to think, okay, what does this actually mean? I tried to step back from it a bit and meditate on it, but meditate on it in an active way. She's not really talking about something passive like mindfulness meditation. She's asking you to engage your whole self in that. And that's certainly something that we try to do in writing classes or in any kind of art practice classes, is to try and get the students to really look at what they're trying to do. If you were asking somebody to make a drawing or a painting, you really want them to be able to see the object from so many different kinds of angles, and that takes a lot of looking. And the same thing, I think, with writing.
And you mentioned writing classes there, and that's interesting because Simone was also taught philosophy of science. So as a teacher, you write about in the book, you know, meeting some students who work in tech or just the experience of teaching. How do you feel technology has affected how they see the world?
The students?
Mm.
I think because, well, the students I teach at Birkbeck are quite diverse in their age ranges, so mm-hmm. it's different for different people. So at the moment, the interesting thing is obviously that we're teaching all online at the moment, and, you know, the disparate capacity of people. So some of the students really don't have much, they're finding the technology harder than others. Some of them are much more able to handle it. So there's definitely a kind of discrepancy and a kind of, you know, some of them have more money and more access to technology, et cetera, et cetera. So that's an interesting thing to think about too. But I'm not sure it replaces the moment of physical being in the room. So the thing I'm finding really frustrating about running classrooms online is that I can't actually look somebody in the eye who I know is about to speak, and I can't generate a discussion quite in the same kind of way because everybody has to speak in turn. So it makes everything much more sort of mannered in a way. It's quite interesting because normally in a discussion, we would sit and think about something and there would be a natural flow to the conversation. And as the teacher, I'm just making sure that the quiet person has said something maybe, and somebody who's been itching to say something is being brought into the conversation and steering sometimes the discussion so that we don't repeat ourselves. And I miss that. I think that's a shame. That's, you know, obviously the internet makes it possible to still carry on learning, but it's a shame not to have the face-to-face reality of other people in the room. There's something quite magic about just being in a room with other people and thinking about something quite hard. There's an interesting exchange of thought and ideas. And at any given point in a writing class, we might be thinking about philosophy or psychology or history, or I don't know, any of these things can come into the discussion depending on what we're looking at.
Yeah, it is interesting. I think lockdown has definitely, as you said, made people realise that no amount of digital connection can substitute for just being, you know, physically present with someone and being able to touch and hug them, which, you know, you're right, does bring a sense of security and safety and happiness in people. So do you see us maybe coming out of this, whenever that might be, renegotiating our relationship to technology and social media? Where do you think we go from here?
Yeah, no, I really hope so. I really, really do. I think that it's one of those things that maybe that lockdown is good. It's very, very clarifying, this situation, I think. And I think that the struggling populism, which is, I think, now struggling, I really do, is just proven to be the shadow show that it was. And that actually what we need is a very different relationship with ourselves and with the people who govern us and the kinds of governments that we might want. And I think it's really interesting what has happened. Facebook has banned QAnon, for example, only a couple of weeks ago. And you're like, okay, so there's been this batshit conspiracy theory spread on the internet for 2 years and you've done nothing about it until 10 minutes before the election, which you think Trump might lose. And you know that the Congress and Senate is going to start coming down on you quite hard. So you're going to maneuver yourself into a position where it looks like you've done something. I mean, I think the corporate malpractice at Facebook particularly is very bad, just in terms of the way that they've ignored so many warnings about the way in which their platform spreads disinformation and hate and blah blah blah. They don't care. They care about who pays for the advertising and the information that they can get out of us, I think, and that seems really clear. So yeah, I think we really need a concerted effort to regulate. I don't think the internet's bad. I think it's an amazing thing, but I think that it has been hijacked perhaps by two things, by a profit motive, which is slightly out of control. And I also think I think there are people who understand how they can manipulate certain matters, certain issues. I mean, companies like Cambridge Analytica are very interesting. Mm. They've promised to be able to go in and parse enough information from the internet about us and then sell it to people who want to change our behavior. And they think they know they can prove that they can do that. I don't know why we're not more frightened of that. I think we should be very scared of the fact that there are people out there selling those services. Mm. So that's for me the tension that we're in at the minute. We're in this very clarifying place where it suddenly seems quite obvious that the internet is sort of, it's not a safe place.
Mm. And kind of extending from that then, what does give you hope?
I think people are realising. I think that there are lots of small grassroots organisations springing up all over the show, countering digital hate. There's the Joy Buluwami's work in the AI and facial recognition software and so on, and there's a lot of noise. I think the sheer monopoly of it, I think even people at Google accept that it needs to be broken up, because there isn't any, you know, we can't innovate anymore when we only have these big monopolies making products. There's no incentive to innovate. And I think that's what's ground to a halt. Innovation stopped. So how can we use this amazing technology to fix things and make things better? That's what I want to know.
Thanks so much, Julia, for a really interesting conversation. Radical Attention is out now with Peninsula Press.
Thank you.
And that's all from us. Thanks for joining us this week on the Prospect Interview. If you enjoyed our podcast, please do leave us a rating and a review. It really does help. Next week, we'll have our arts and books editor, Samir Rahim, on judging the Booker Prize. Goodbye, stay safe, and see you next week.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com. The number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.